A massive database of Florida students' information, and a trip inside the largest childhood detention center in the country. Hello and welcome to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. We'll talk about how Florida is falling behind on a deadline to create a new statewide database to prevent the next school shooting. And that's while activists are raising concerns about what the database will be tracking. Also, an inside look behind the doors of the childhood detention facility in Homestead. We speak with a California-based attorney that recently visited the center, which he described as having prison-like conditions. He'll explain the federal court filings in place to shut the center down. Finally, have you looked up recently? Royal poinciana trees are in full bloom across South Florida. You'll hear from a man who's been studying the poincianas for decades and explain why you should love them too. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. What information is the state of Florida collecting about your child? The state's Department of Education is developing a statewide database that could include information about students' social media accounts, criminal incidents, mental health, and more. It was mandated as part of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act that passed the legislature last year. But the database has faced serious roadblocks to its completion, and there are still many questions about the scope of the data being collected. Ben Harold is the technology reporter for Education Week. He joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Mr. Harold, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Ben, what was the initial idea for this database that came out of this major law that passed after last year's tragedy in Parkland?
Well, the place to start, I think, is that the law, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act that was passed after the tragedy in Parkland is 105 pages long. And most of the attention has gone to things like the restrictions on access to guns and provisions about training and arming some school employees, these kind of hot button, highly visible issues. But kind of tucked within the end of the law was a provision that mandated the creation of what lawmakers called it a, quote, centralized integrated data repository. And so what that means essentially is that it's a big database to be run by the state and include information from multiple sources, including schools, the State Department of Education, state and local law enforcement agencies, social service agencies, as well as real-time monitoring of social media posts across the state. And to understand why Florida lawmakers started down this path, you don't really have to look any further than the history of the Parkland shooter, who had posted to social media about wanting to kill people and about hurting himself and about wanting to buy a gun. He had searched the internet for things like, is killing people easy? Multiple tips were made to both the FBI and local law enforcement about concerns about the shooter, none of which received much of the way of follow-up. And he was also examined on multiple occasions by mental health professionals, again, without any follow-up that prevented him from obtaining a gun and doing what he did. And so the idea here is that those warning signs were missed because the pieces were scattered, and the hope is that this new database would be able to tie all those things together to create a comprehensive picture that would allow to hopefully identify potential shooters before it happens.
And Ben, I'm someone that I've covered privacy in this age of big data, and it's not just social media posts we're talking about in particular here. There's things that go way beyond what someone's just posting online. Can you outline the scope of the information that could be gathered on students with this?
Sure. Well, that's where things start to get concerning kind of quickly and confusing quickly, because we still don't know exactly what's planned to be in this database. And the Florida Department of Education would not agree to be interviewed about it. So Education Week was able to obtain documents through public records requests. And basically what we found is that we were able to learn about the types of data that have been under discussion as part of the database. And that included agencies including the Florida Departments of Education and Law Enforcement, the State Child Welfare Department, the Department of Children and Families, school districts across the state. And the types of data that they discussed sharing into this were really far-reaching and kind of eyebrow-raising. They included records on foster care placement and child protected services for 9 million people, criminal records, including unverified tips and suspicious activity reports, 2.5 million records related to involuntary psychiatric examination, substance abuse and mental health records for another 3.3 million Floridians, information on hundreds of thousands of juvenile offenders, and then all kinds of educational information, everything from students' immunization status to their disciplinary histories to whether or not they had been bullied based on their race or religion or disability status. There were some concerns expressed by the agencies about whether they were legally allowed to share this information, and we suspect that it has been pared down dramatically from what was, or significantly from what was discussed. But the concerning thing is we really don't know right now exactly what's going in here.
And how unique is this kind of project, kind of a statewide database pulling in data from all sorts of state agencies and different school districts and kind of integrating that together in something that could essentially be monitored in real time? Is there precedent for that somewhere else in the country?
Sort of. So the idea of integrated databases are fairly well established, and you see those in many locations around the country, including in Broward and Miami-Dade counties in Florida. And so, but generally the idea is kind of merging social service and educational and sometimes law enforcement records in an anonymized way that are not tied to individuals, primarily for research purposes. So researchers want to be able to ask questions like, hey, you know, what do we know about how well schools are serving homeless students? Or sometimes, in a few instances, they will do kind of individual case management and say, you know, be able to look at, well, if we have a group of students that are chronically absent, maybe it has something to do with their involvement in the foster care system, or maybe they're having probation issues. How can we kind of coordinate the system's response to them? But three things really make what Florida is working on very different. So one is the idea that it's statewide. That's new and different and bigger than what we've seen elsewhere. The second is including social media information in with these other social service and public government records. And then the third and probably the most significant is the idea that the Florida database appears to be planned to be used to monitor and possibly sanction individuals. So if you raise flags, you might hear from law enforcement or social service agencies in a way that could be punitive. So it's not just for helping improve services or do research. The idea is to surveil the population and try and step in before something bad happens.
And Ben, speaking directly to that, one of the things that it looks like is still on the table from your reporting is that students that have been the victim of bullying because their status as an LGBT individual or because of their race, that information is still on the table to be used to potentially flag someone for attention in this database. Can you explain some of the concerns that were raised to you from activists about what that would mean?
Sure. And I would say first that as far as we know, based on the documents Education Week was able to obtain, that was still on the table. The Florida Department of Education wouldn't confirm or deny or discuss that. But based on the data templates that we saw, it appeared that that was part of it. And so privacy and civil liberties advocates are very concerned about that. You know, the idea that someone could be flagged as a potential school shooter because they had been bullied because they were Black or Latinx or because they had a disability or because they were LGBTQ, all of those things, you know, raise really immediate concerns about possible punishment and surveillance and, you know, kind of someone who's actually a victim of bullying or harassment then being kind of re-victimized by being kind of identified as a possible school shooter or as a possible threat based on that. As we understand it, again, from reviewing the documents, the idea there is that state officials tried to, you know, develop a profile of some of the characteristics that identify school shooters, and that can include things like feeling angry and wanting revenge, a history of being bullied or harassed and seeking retribution for that. We think that's the motivation for including it in there, but certainly privacy, civil liberties, and disability advocates are up in arms about that.
Got it. And just for our listeners, I want to clarify, this is your reporting, and the Department of Education did not respond to any request for an interview that you asked them to kind of expand on this or to clarify anything?
They did not agree to an interview. We discussed it for well over a month, but never actually got anyone on the phone willing to discuss.
Got it. And the data that's being discussed, would that be for public school students, or would that include public charter schools or private schools? Is there any idea of that?
So as best as we understand right now, it would be both public school districts and public charter schools in the state sharing information into the database. So certainly would include all of the public school and charter school students in Florida. And then in terms of private school students, as we understand it, the law enforcement and social service and child welfare information that could be included in there would not necessarily be limited to only public school students. It would be, you know, everyone who had been served by those agencies. So other, you know, children who are attending other types of schools and potentially adults as well could get have their information included in the database.
I'm speaking with Education Week's technology reporter, Ben Harold. The state of Florida is working on a massive database of students' background information in order to prevent future school shootings. A new investigation from Education Week found there's been major roadblocks in the development of the database. You can find Ben's story on our Twitter, WLRN Sundial. He's joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. So, Ben, what was the timeline that was set in place by this legislation?
The original law required the database, the centralized data repository, and the social media monitoring service to be up and functional and integrated with each other December 1st of last year, of 2018. That obviously did not happen. And in February, Governor DeSantis expressed his displeasure with that, and it was part of an executive order saying the delays were unacceptable and mandating that it be up and running as of August 1st, in a couple months this summer. Everything that we have heard, which again is not much, but from updates made to state lawmakers and state officials, was that that is still the intent, that it will be operational as of August 1st.
And there was some contractual issues that might have contributed to that, according to your reporting. Can you just walk us through briefly where that stands with who is actually going to build this out?
Well, there's two parts of it, of the integrated data repository that the state is working on. So one, you know, challenge is just pulling together all this information from different state agencies. And the Florida Department of Education, as we understand it, is ultimately responsible for that. But they're looking at some of the existing databases and data sets available to build off of. But there's the second piece of monitoring social media across the state of Florida. And so the idea there was to contract that out to one of the companies that do this. And there are a handful of companies that are doing this for schools and universities and public government and other, you know, private entities already. And so last summer, the state of Florida issued a, you know, essentially a request for proposals for companies interested in doing this. They were supposed to make that award in late 2018, but that process has gotten bogged down in delays and confusion and protests and lots of uncertainty. And so as best we understand right now, the bid was reissued earlier this spring and companies are still competing for that contract, but it has not been awarded yet and we don't know when it will be.
And Ben, if the database were to go into effect with the latest information that we have, the kind of the latest contours of what it looks like they're looking to integrate here, would there be any potential for lawsuits because of it, or you know, would this potentially violate any state or federal laws, or is there concern that it could?
Well, what we saw in the documents we obtained in these kind of exchanges between the Florida Department of Education and other state agencies is that there were lots of concerns raised by state officials about whether under the both state and federal privacy laws related to educational records and also related to health and mental health records, what was allowed to be shared. And so certainly there's a lot of concerns there, and we just don't have a lot of visibility right now into how state officials are trying to reconcile those concerns. But beyond just the kind of violating the laws, there's, you know, what I heard a lot from privacy advocates who are looking at this is that there's just a lack of guidelines and guardrails in both the legislation and in what has been publicly communicated about this project so far. So some really basic questions like, how long would this information be retained? If we have foster care records and criminal histories and school discipline records and social media posts for a student who's an 11th grader today, will the state of Florida retain that indefinitely for 5 years, for 10 years? We don't know. And certainly that you know, is a big question. Also things like who would have access to the information. If information is collected on my child, would I, as a parent, have a right to view that information? And if I think it's an accurate request, that it be fixed. All of those things are unclear right now. There's not a lot of detail in either the legislation or in the documents that we've been able to find from the state around that. All of that is raising concerns.
And you brought it to my mind in terms of who would have access to it. If the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has access to it, they share a lot of information with the FBI. Would the federal government potentially have access to some of that information as well?
We don't know. What we do know at the moment is that what it seems most likely to happen, and again, this isn't confirmed, this is based on the review of the documents that we obtained, is that each school now has a school a threat assessment team, which usually consists of both law enforcement officers and educators or counseling officials at the state, at the school. And so the idea is that if there is a student or an incident or a young person that is flagged as a potential threat, that information would be communicated to those teams. There's a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty in the main federal student data privacy law that would regulate that. Federal officials have been trying to clear that up with the idea of trying to make that information sharing easier so law enforcement can get that information. But the details of exactly how it would work and what kind of safeguards need to be put in place for it to work legally, all of that is still a little fuzzy. And that's, I think, why privacy advocates are so eager to kind of see the details on this, to understand the nuts and bolts of how it will work.
Do we know at this point what happens if this isn't completed by the deadline mandated by Governor DeSantis?
We don't. And I think that there's kind of competing forces at work here. And on one hand, certainly after, a tragedy like Parkland and then seeing ongoing incidents and tragedies like this at schools across the country after this, you can understand the urgency to act, to do something and to do it quickly. I think that's driving a lot of the tight timeline that lawmakers originally had and the governor currently has. But on the other side of the equation is, the concern that trying to rush this is a recipe to really make big mistakes. And particularly given the lack of clarity around these kind of privacy safeguards and these kind of basic questions that need to be answered, there's a lot of concern that trying to rush this will lead to bad outcomes.
We've been speaking with Ben Harreld. He covers technology for Education Week. Florida's Department of Education is working on creating a database filled with information from students in order to prevent future school shootings. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Still to come, we hear from an attorney that got an inside look at the Homestead Detention Center and spoke with a number of the children there. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero filling in for Luis Hernandez. The Trump administration announced yesterday it will be drastically cutting federal aid to migrant childhood detention facilities. The largest childhood detention facility in the United States is based in Homestead. It houses more than 2,000 children. Funding cuts means no access to formal education, public attorneys, or recess time. The move comes just days after a 700-page document was filed in federal court by California-based attorneys detailing the, quote, prison-like conditions children at the facility are experiencing. J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda is one of the immigration attorneys that visited Homestead. He had the opportunity to speak with a number of the children in detention. And he's also the author of No Human is Illegal, an attorney on the front lines of the immigration war. Sepulveda joins us from the studios of UC Davis in California. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, JJ, federal officials have been very protective of access to this facility. I've been down there multiple times myself with congressional members who have been denied access. Reporters have been given limited tours of the area. How were you and your team of attorneys able to get inside the facility and speak with the minors directly?
So we work as a part of a team that sort of monitors the Flores Settlement Agreement, which is a settlement back from 1997 between the federal government and all the unaccompanied minors detained and accompanied minors detained within the U.S. And that gives us special access to facilities because it's a class action and we technically represent all detained children within the U.S. And so not only do we get to tour the facilities, but we also get to speak with the youth. And that's sort of where the story really comes out.
And can you summarize the findings of what you detailed in this really expansive court filing?
Well, the filing has a lot of declarations from the youth because, like I was saying, that's really where the story comes out. Even if congressional officials or reporters are given tours of the facility, that's it's pretty. You can gloss over some of the worst things that are happening just with the tour.
Got it. If you could summarize some of the things that you directly heard from some of the children, what were some of the things that they were telling you and your team?
Well, so the facility is separated into a north and south side, and on the north side there's 17-year-olds, and on the south side there's 13 through 16-year-olds. And so if they're siblings, for example, they will be separated, and they will only see each other for an hour a week. The food is subpar. Kids, you mentioned they're talking about cutting educational services. One of the chief complaints about kids was already the educational services. When they go to classrooms in this massive tent, which has classrooms separated into sort of these cubicle-like things where there's no roof, and so all the noise from all the classrooms sort of floods together, and they can't hear anything of what the teachers are talking to them about. They're indoors for 23 hours a day, and so they're talking about cutting recreational activities. So, you know, that those soccer goals or soccer balls, those are things that are during their hour a day outside are the things that bring joy to them and make the other 23 hours bearable.
And just for context for our listeners, this facility is not under the Miami-Dade School Board does not have access to this facility. It's one of the school board has voiced concerns over that because it's on federal property. They don't have the ability to get in there. I just want to bring context to our listeners for that. JJ,
yes and no. From my understanding was that the superintendent for the Miami-Dade County did offer to provide services, and they do provide services to two other facilities in the area. And it's not so much that it's on federal land so that they can't provide such services. It's that Homestead rejected those services.
Yes. Thank you. Can you tell us, JJ, what was your first impressions of the facility when you first visited? Can you kind of paint us a picture of what it looks like on the ground there?
Well, it's right next to the Air Reserve Base, and so every now and then you'll hear these military jets flying overhead. It's all fenced off with this dark green mesh, so you can't see inside, and the kids can't see outside. And it's also an old Job Corps building facility, and so there's one side that are dorms, and the other side is just the office buildings, which they've converted into these warehouse-like facilities where kids sleep. You know, there's 144 bunk beds in one room. And, you know, kids are sleeping. You can barely walk by these bunk beds. My shoulders were, you know, touching each side of the bunk bed as I walked by them. So there's not much privacy. And the showers, they get reports if they shower for more than 5 minutes. And there's, you know, 30 shower stalls right next to each other. So the fact that people think it's have said that it's a summer camp is just way off.
And you've visited a number of these facilities. How would you compare what you saw in Homestead to other places you visited in different parts of the country?
Most of the facilities I visited, apart from the Tornillo facility in Texas, which was also temporary, the other facilities are permanent and licensed. So they have a license to care for children, and they're permanent facilities. Homestead is really a makeshift sort of built into a place where it shouldn't be facility. And it feels very temporary, and that affects a lot of the services that they're able to provide.
So you said it feels temporary, but it's my understanding there's, because of the nature of this, it's not able, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. They aren't necessarily actually temporary. Some of the children have been there for a very long time, but it is temporary in name. Am I getting that right?
Exactly. No, what I was saying, it's makeshift in a temporary sense, that it's the buildings are not there for a licensed childcare facility. It's an old Job Corps site that's been repurposed and was opened at one point during the Obama administration, then closed and now reopened. And then the idea now is to expand it, I believe, to 3,200 kids, which I don't know where they would fit those.
And in terms of how long the children have been there for, out of the children you and your team spoke to, how long had these children been in the center?
I spoke with one girl who had been there around 7 months. She was the facility was, there's case managers that try and work with the children to be reunited with their sponsors. And they had been asking her, her aunt was the one that was trying to receive her. And they'd been asking her to prove the relationship by providing photos to them. And this was a young girl from the mountains of Guatemala who had never seen a cell phone before. And so she couldn't provide any photos to show the relationship. And so they just kept delaying and delaying and delaying the process. And little by little, she was getting more and more frustrated. And she was there for 7 months when I spoke with her. And she cried immediately.
And the ability for these children to talk to friends, family from, you know, on phones, if they do in fact have cell phone numbers, what is their ability to access kind of those communication devices?
I believe it was twice a week for 10 minutes as the conversations they can have, and they're not private. They're in these small rooms where their case managers are located, and again, the cubicle-like setup. So there's 30 cubicles in this room, and they're barely separated. And so any conversation that a child wants to have with a potential family member, or potential sponsor, or a family member is listened to by the person next to them. And so it's very hard for them to share what is happening to them and what is going on.
I'm speaking with J.J. Mulligan-Sepulveda, an immigration attorney at UC Davis in California. Sepulveda recently traveled to the Homestead Detention Facility, where he spoke with children about their living conditions and experiences there. He, along with a team of attorneys, filed federal court documents last week detailing their concerns with this facility. J.J., you had the opportunity to speak with Bernadine Leslie Wood, the director of the facility. How did she respond to your concerns about the living conditions that these minors are living in?
Well, that's a complex question. From when we spoke, she admitted that they were, you know, logistically challenged, as she put it, the facility, and that they were doing their best to accommodate this growing population. But from speaking with the youth, you get more of a story of what's actually happening there than you would from speaking with directors or staff, because they have sort of a vested interest in making sure you know that everything is A-okay where they are.
And you told us that one of the ways you were able to get in and get access was because you're part of this group that exercises kind of oversight with the Flores Agreement. Can you explain to us exactly what that agreement is and what the significance of it is in this case?
Well, it's a very significant legal instrument because it defines the basic conditions of confinement of how accompanied and unaccompanied minors can be detained within the United States. And it's sort of a mini constitution for undocumented immigrant children. And as I'm sure people have read in the news, the Trump administration has made it a priority to get rid of the Flores Settlement Agreement because, from their words, they believe that people are coming to this country only because of the protections being provided in agreements like this, and that they need to be able to detain families together for longer periods of time. And so they're saying that it's to protect children, but it's an absurd argument because you wouldn't tell a soldier going to war that he's safer without armor.
And is your ultimate goal here to, with the visit and the court filing, to shut down the detention center or make kind of serious changes to the way that it's being operated?
Well, the facility is open because their argument is that it's an influx, that they're receiving too many children and they can't hold them in licensed facilities. But at the time that Homestead opened, I believe there was about 80 to 85% full the licensed shelters. And so what we would like is for these children to get the custody and care that they deserve in a licensed facility, a place where they can receive education, mental health services, have privacy, and generally the protections that the Flores Settlement Agreement offers children.
And your visit came, or shall I say the filings you made in court, came just before the Trump administration announced this week that they're cutting funding for detention facilities for these unaccompanied minors. What will these cuts mean for the thousands of children that remain in the facility and their access to things like playing soccer?
Are you talking about Homestead specifically?
Yes, yes.
I don't know. It's unclear because it's so early in the process, and I think there's still debate going on about in Congress about what to appropriate and how to appropriate it. But the Homestead facility is run by a private corporation, Comprehensive Health Services. And so you can imagine if the contract is saying that they don't have money to provide these services, a for-profit corporation that is concerned with profits will be less likely to provide these services if it's going to affect their bottom line. For example, BCFS, a nonprofit, has already said that they will continue providing these services out of their own pocket, even if the government no longer provides them the funding to do so.
And this particular facility in Homestead is able to some way circumvent the 20-day maximum for children to be held in detention away from their families. Can you explain how it's able to circumvent that a little bit?
Well, it's complex because there is no the 20-day rule, so to speak, is comes from a court case that said that if there's no licensed facility available to place a child, they need to go to the least restrictive setting, and they can't be in this place for any more than 20 days. And I don't know, to be honest, why Homestead thinks that this doesn't apply to them. And I think that is raised within our court filing.
And in your estimation, is there an ethical manner in which the government can detain children of undocumented immigrants? Would that be just following what you would consider to be the letter of the Flores Agreement? Is that the standard bearer here?
It is. And there is also a presumption towards release to having children with their parents or their family members within the U.S. The Trump administration has long sort of pushed this mistreatment or deterrence by mistreatment, and detaining children for long periods of time definitely follows that script. But if children are with their sponsor where they should be, receiving mental health services, education, they will still go to immigration court. It doesn't change anything. It just means that they're not detained in these horrible jail-like conditions for long periods of time.
And is there another country somewhere else that you've been aware of that's following this kind of procedure, that's doing it pretty much what you're describing here?
Well, in Spain, for example, there is a law that if children are under 18, they cannot be held in detention. They have like these halfway houses where children receive educational services, mental health services, and they're free to go in and out of these facilities. And that, to me, seems a much more humane way of dealing with children who have suffered immense trauma and who are without family members.
And what are the next steps in the court proceedings?
Well, it's the motion to enforce was filed Monday, I believe, is a way to try and enforce the Flores settlement agreement, saying that the government is not complying with the terms of this. And so it's in the Central District in California Federal District Court now, where sort of the Flores settlement agreement resides in front of a judge there. And the judge will be reviewing those filings shortly.
Do you plan to ask the court to expedite this case? Because obviously the detentions are ongoing.
That's above my pay grade, I'm afraid.
That's fine. And we'll leave it at that. We've been speaking with J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda. He's an immigration attorney at UC Davis in California. And recently he traveled to the Homestead Detention Facility, where he spoke with children about their experiences. You can check out WLRN's reporting on the Homestead Detention Center at WLRN.org. J.J., thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we change gears as the weekend approaches. Do you have any royal poinciana trees in your neighborhood? We'll explain while they're all over South Florida. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero. It's that time of year where all across South Florida, we begin to see deep red, orange, and sometimes yellow flowers coming from the tall trees with these wide branches. They're called royal poinciana trees, flamboyant in Spanish, because they're flamboyant. And it's hard not to notice them. This week, the flower tree will have its own celebration, the Royal Poinciana Fiesta. It's been going on for 82 years at this point. Starting at the Coral Gables Library, attendees will hear lectures from plant expert Steve Pearson. He's the executive director of the University of Miami's Gifford Arboretum. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome. Good to see you.
Also, we've asked on Facebook and Twitter for everyone out there to share your tree photos with us. Just look up WLRN Sundial to share them. Steve, let me just ask you, where did your interest in this one specific plant come from?
It started about 25 years ago. I was a young lawyer, and I got brought into the Miami Beautification Committee, and there was a lot of interest in that group. They were sponsoring the Royal Poinciana Fiesta at that time. I was generally interested in flowering trees, but my real love with the poinciana started then.
Do you remember when you first saw one that it captivated your attention? I mean, these things are very loud, you know, for your eyes.
Well, I'm a native of Miami, so I saw them very early in my life, and they were part of my life. I remember as a child seeing artists on South Miami Avenue gather to paint the trees that are so famous along that stretch.
And I'm from here too. I don't remember the first time. I just thought I would ask you that. Can you describe to someone listening that might not know exactly which tree we're talking about how these flowers look?
Well, they range from scarlet to yellow, but the most common poinciana colors are shades of orange. We emphasize, and in the workshop we'll be showing people the range of colors, but they're usually a deep orange.
And how many of these trees are there in South Florida? Is there any census? Do we know how many there are? I mean, from what I've seen on some of the main avenues, boulevard streets, there's a lot of them planted, but do we know how many there are?
We don't have an actual count, but it's widely believed that we have more poinciana's in our area than anywhere else in the world. They're a pan-tropical tree that comes from Madagascar, an island off the east coast of Africa. But there, they're being cut down for firewood, even though poinciana isn't a good firewood. They're also, the young leaves are even eaten as a starvation food. I don't recommend that to people. It's not a culinary item for most people, but they can be eaten.
So Madagascar is quite a ways away from Miami. Is there a particular story that this plant took from the Indian Ocean across the Atlantic over to here?
Well, they're originally taken to England, and then they were distributed. I don't know the exact story of how, but you know, they're all over the tropics today.
And is there one neighborhood, one park, one place where you've noticed that there is a cluster of these trees that are blooming right now that someone listening might be able to go to for a nice picnic tomorrow?
One of the reasons I like the tree dandy is you see them in all, you know, ethnic neighborhoods, all socioeconomic class neighborhoods. But if you look for the most trees, Coral Gables is one of the best spots. They had a man who really promoted the trees there back in the 30s, and they planted many of them. Miami Beach is another area where a single person made a difference to really promote the tree. I might mention that the oldest documented tree we have is the one at the Kampong, the former home of Dr. and Mrs. Fairchild.
How old is that?
It was planted in 1917, so 102 years.
And how long would a royal poinciana typically live for? What's the high end of what they're known to have lived?
That's probably getting close. They're not like a sequoia or a bristlecone pine that would live thousands of years. But you know, a lot of it's how well they're cared for. I think 100 years though is a good lifespan for a poinciana.
A cool historical fact you mentioned to my producer was that years ago, when air conditioning didn't exist, these plants had a different purpose. Can you share us a little bit about what that other purpose was?
Well, they were naturally a way of controlling your climate at your house. Before the days of air conditioners, poinciana were planted by early settlers not only for their beauty, but because they're deciduous. That means in the wintertime, they would drop their leaves, let the sun shine in to warm your home. Then in the summer, when the blazing sun is out and the heat index goes through the roof, they give a lot of shade. So it's a way of controlling, you know, the climate around your home.
And, you know, flash forward, we have air conditioning now in 2019, thank goodness. But we are talking about climate in a different context in terms of saving energy, combating climate change. Is there any, you know, would these trees help control the climate and maybe reduce people's energy levels? Is this something that you're encouraging people to do, to plant more of these trees?
Absolutely. All trees will help do that. I mean, urban areas are famously known as heat islands because they produce much more heat than rural areas. So the need for trees in urban areas is even greater than other areas. So we should be planting trees that have wide canopies that cover our streets, shade our houses. And here in Miami, about 20 years ago, we had an organization called Cool Communities. And one of the emphases, in particular Dr. Jack Parker, was teaching people about how to use trees to shade your air conditioning unit, to shade your house in the best ways. We were also teaching people about the benefits of white roofs, et cetera, insulation, to lower your energy bills and your, you know, energy use.
And it's my understanding that you've planted many of these, not only Royal Poincianas, but other trees. Where have you done some of your plantings?
Well, my public planting started back about 30 years ago with the City of Miami Beautification Committee, which at that time was the sponsor of the Royal Poinciana Fiesta. But we started planting trees along the thoroughfares, I-95, 836, when nobody was planting any trees out there. It was considered a no man's land. And we showed how you could plant trees, and we used lots of mulch, and we started with small trees. And it's, many of those trees are still out there today.
I'm speaking with Steve Pearson. He's the executive director of the University of Miami's Gifford Arboretum and the vice president of Tremendous. This weekend is the Royal Poinciana Fiesta. He's telling us more about the history of the blooming orange trees and the South Florida celebration. Find us on Facebook and Twitter and share your tree photos with us. Just look us up at WLRN Sundial to share. So, Steve, let's get to the festival. This is the 82nd year, is that right?
Yes, it's the oldest continuously running festival in Dade County.
And for someone who's never been, I've never been, tell me about what to expect if you actually go there.
Well, we have a range of events over 3 days. The culmination is Monday night at Fairchild Garden, where we have, at 6 o'clock, we have trolley tours of Fairchild Garden. And then it's followed by a celebration where we coronate a queen in court. We have music by Joe Donato and Brian Murphy. And we also have our featured artist this year, Linda Aprileti, who's a very, very good landscape painter here. And it's just a fun event.
And can I ask you to... You said coronate a queen in court. What is that?
That's something that goes back to 1947. Originally, the queens and courts always came from University of Miami. Today, we give the queen in court are selected from exceptional high school seniors. And one of the criteria is, it's not really a beauty contest. One of the big criteria is academic achievement and an interest in the community, and in particular, an interest in the environment and some of the problems the world's facing in that regard today.
So 82 years is a long time for any institution in any community. Why do you think that this particular festival celebrating the Poinciana trees has had such staying power here in this community?
Well, the Poincianas are such a beautiful tree. I mean, they're world-renowned. You know, at the workshop on Saturday, we're going to play songs, different songs about the Poinciana that, you know, Frank Sinatra to Bing Crosby have sung these songs, many jazz artists. But it's a celebration not only of the beauty of nature, but it's a reminder of how important plants and trees are to our environment. And that should be something that I think is vitally important to all of us.
And we have a really, you know, some of my coworkers make fun of me because I'm a tree guy and I do some stories about trees and I'm like the plant guy, but I love them. It's one of the best things about living here. If I bought a house, I did not buy a house, but if I did buy a house and I'm a homeowner and I want to plant one, what advice would you have to someone who wants to put one of these in the ground?
I would start with a young seedling. I think it's not only a waste of money, but you'll get a healthier tree in the long run if you start with a small tree, properly plant it, care for it in the initial stages, and then leave it alone. One of the things that I get questions about is why my poinsettia doesn't bloom. And the first question I ask is, well, do you water the tree? And people proudly say, yes, I water it, you know, every day or once a week. And I say, aha, that's the problem. These trees evolved in Madagascar. They are, you know, go through extreme wet periods, then extreme dry periods. And that's why they're so suited to Miami, because that's our natural climate pattern. You know, winters are dry, summers are wet. And they're very well adapted to our climate. They're well adapted to our soil. And that's why you see so many of them. They're thriving on benign neglect.
Set it and forget it then, basically.
Well, any young tree, when you first plant it, you should care for it the first year. It's like having a child. You don't just take the baby and throw it out there.
You got to give it the bottle for a little bit.
You got to give it the bottle. You got to let it grow up. But the older it gets, the more it keeps care of itself if you're giving it the proper, you know, conditioning as a young plant or child, as the case may be.
And going back to the festival, who are the people that go to the festival? Like, if you would characterize them as a group?
I say it's people that love nature, that appreciate the beauty of trees and nature. It's a diverse group, all age groups, ethnic types. It's just a great festival because it celebrates a great tree and reminds us of the importance of trees.
And you mentioned all age groups. Is there people from younger generations that you see showing interest in this? I mean, I show an interest in this. I'm 33, but I feel like sometimes I'm the exception. Do you see younger people really appreciating the trees that surround us?
I think that's changing. You know, if you look at many of the plant societies here in South Florida, they're having a trouble that, you know, more and more the members are elderly people. But now we're starting to see young people get involved, and I think it's a great trend.
And Steve, you're the vice president for Tremendous, a group of volunteers here in Miami that gets together and plants trees across the city. Can you just tell us a little bit about the group?
Tremendous Miami is a volunteer-based group. We have planted, I think, 24,000 plus trees in Miami-Dade County. Our two primary projects today are we are restoring the Maritime Hammock at the historic Virginia Key Beach Park. We've planted over 14,000 trees out there. Our other major project is FIU. FIU has a preserve that was doing very well, and parts that are still doing very well, but other parts were neglected, and certain invasive exotic plants marched in and started taking over. So we are working there to first eliminate those exotics and then to replant the native plants that would belong there. And one thing that distinguishes Tremendous is we are very careful. We study what should have been there before man. We don't just say, well, it's a native, you can plant it. We study what belongs in this kind of ecosystem. And another thing that really distinguishes our group is we plant trees and we go back and maintain them.
So, Steve, the city and the county have been working on projects like the Underline to add more greener spaces in the city. But in your opinion, do you think the city has done enough?
No, but the Underline is an interesting example because I know they mean well to create all this synergy there, but Tremendous Miami had planted all the trees that you see along US 1. If you go south on US 1 along the Metro Rail from where you get off I-95 to Bird Road, you'll see many flowering trees, because that's what the city said they wanted, but there's also some native sections. But we were kind of unceremoniously, not kicked off, but, you know, no further support for us or encouragement to be out there when they started the underline.
And one last question. What are you most looking forward to this weekend?
I love it all. We have a new activity, which is on Sunday. There's going to be a tea at the Merrick House. And I'm thinking that's going to be really unusual. We've never done that before. It's kind of a little bit of old world charm combined with the celebration. But I look forward to it all.
We've been speaking with Steve Pearson. He's the executive director of the University of Miami's Gifford Arboretum and a speaker at this weekend's Royal Ponciana Festival in Coral Gables. Find us on Facebook and Twitter and share your tree photos with us. We want to see them. Just look us up at WLRN Sundial to share. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And that's Sundial for Thursday, June 6th. I'm Danny Rivero. Thank you so much for listening. Luis Hernandez will be back with you next week.